after 23 years of saving lives.
All you see is the worst. Over and over again.
A Milwaukee firefighter was prepared to take his own.
I had my gun to my head three times.
This week on Open Record.
That's it. You're going to Maryland.
What firefighters in Wisconsin are doing to battle compassion fatigue.
That place saved my life.
From the Fox 6 Studios, this is Open Record. I'm Brian Polson, and I'm joined this week by Open Record's executive producer, Sarah Smith. Hello, Sarah.
Hi.
And we're also joined by Fox 6 reporter and Wake Up News anchor, Suzanne Spencer. Welcome back to Open Record,
Thanks
Suzanne.
Thanks for having me.
And welcome to your first video appearance on Open Record. So good to have you here. Now, we are recording this episode on Wednesday, July 19th for release on Thursday, July 20th. And tonight, Suzanne, you have a story airing on Fox 6 News that explores a side of firefighting that I think is often neglected. We're hearing more about it now, and that is the mental health and well-being of those who encounter some pretty dark and troubling things on the job. Tell us a little bit about who you talked to here and how this story came about.
We know the trauma that first responders often see, police officers, firefighters, what they see responding to these scenes. But I think this story really explores what you don't see and what you don't talk about, which is the effect on them after they go to those scenes, when they go home. So I think that the big challenge for us with this story, Sarah, helped me find someone who could actually speak to this issue. I went to a couple different departments and we just simply couldn't find someone willing to talk about this.
So you knew you wanted to talk about this issue, but you didn't have a person to profile.
And that was really challenging because we're a visual medium. We needed to find someone who could talk about something that we could show, whether that was a scene of an accident, a fire, a specific instance. And I think that was the challenge, was finding someone who would be willing to share their mental health journey, but also have it be something local or national that we could actually show to give it some context to people at home. Because obviously we're a TV station. We have to show what we're talking about.
And that this is one of those issues, whether you're talking about the fire service or anywhere else, mental health is hard to sort of visualize, to make it a TV-friendly topic, but it's a very important one. And it sounds like you found a way.
Yeah, I think mental health blanket term is one of those. It's easy to not feel as invested in the topic unless you hear the stories behind it. And for me, I really wanted to find someone who could paint the picture of what this looked like in their individual circumstance and how they used this experience to kind of create more good, because it's a hard topic to talk about without a light at the end of the tunnel. And thankfully for Lieutenant Brent Jones, you know, he had a lot of light in his life throughout his really, you know, troubled journey, but there was light at the end. And we tried to articulate that in this story.
So right away in the story that you'll see tonight, we meet Lieutenant Brent Jones. He's now retired. But can you kind of walk us through a little bit of his story and, you know, how he got into firefighting and what he's doing?
Yeah, he is the son of a deputy with the Wisconsin State Patrol. Law enforcement is definitely in his upbringing and that structure, that routine. He's a Marine. He joined Milwaukee Fire in 2000 and for 23 years worked as a firefighter on the streets. You don't just cover fires, you cover accidents, crashes, a lot of different traumatic events. But, you know, something that he did that was really unique was he was on the honor guard. So he found several different honor guards across the country and also helped teach honor guard to people across the country, which is a very valiant thing, but also comes with its own set of grief because you're constantly dealing with people's funeral arrangements and processions.
Their worst times
in their life.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's what really struck me here is you've got someone who's anyone of the fire service who's gone to these scenes, who's seen some of the dark stuff they see, that's already obviously going to wear on you. But this was sort of another level because he's not going necessarily when he's doing these honor guard things to the scenes of a fatal fire or a fatal car crash or something like that. But he's going to those places where the people are enduring the loss. So now he's got a whole different kind of exposure to sort of death and loss. And you said, I think, 500 of these over his
500
career?
500 line of duty deaths. I thought the story would be what he saw as a firefighter. I thought it would be the fires, the people he saved. And it really wasn't that. I think he used his honor guard service as a coping mechanism for probably what he saw in the fire service. So it was really both of those coupled together that I think created such a level of grief that ultimately just got to him.
So in doing the, you know, being a firefighter, first responders and all that stuff, and like you mentioned, it's not just fires, it's crashes and other events that happen. You know, and so they respond to these and do their service, and then it's every day, and then it's compounded, and maybe they come back to the station and they're not really talking about it, for whatever reason. But then can you talk a little bit about how he kind of, you know, articulated the compounding of events and the trauma?
Yeah, he was candid. He was going through a divorce, so we're all people first, and personal life caught up to him during some pretty challenging times that he was experiencing professionally. And he said that was the first time that he had his gun to his head, was when he was going through his divorce. And then she shared two more times after that. And when he, you know, shared that with me, I never heard him say those words. I didn't know that was his experience. I knew just because the fire chief had connected me to him. He said, hey, there's a guy I really think that would be willing to talk about this. But hearing those words, you just get the gravity that this wasn't just a one-time thing, a one day of frustration. This was a long time coming. So I really think it was both the job, but also personal life obviously factors into this too.
Well, you can't really escape one right for the other, because mm-hmm. there's a different kind of trauma in every place. I hear this and I think about, you know, in the news profession, we often talk about, deal with, go to the scenes of things that are traumatic and tragic. And I've had people tell me that or ask me, boy, it must be really tough to deal with that day after day. And I think especially doing investigative reporting, I'm sort of shielded from a lot of that because I'm talking about bigger issues and I'm not going to those event scenes like I used to in the early days. But I even then, I always felt like we were at a bit of a distance. But for those who are right there in the face of it, he talks about pulling people out of burning buildings. One of the sound bites that really stuck with me was, he said, after 23 years, all the people I pulled from burning buildings, only two of them survived. And you think, how many did he pull out who didn't survive? Mm-hmm. And I imagine you go through that in an individual situation. You go, that's the job. This is what I signed up for. But then you do it again and you do it again. At some point, those faces, those sounds, those stories have to kind of haunt you.
And you think about, he gave a lot of stuff we didn't use in the story that was pretty graphic in nature of what he would see on the job and the conditions of people, you know, that he was helping, trying to save. And yeah, at some point you try to find the hope in what you're doing. I think, like, you know, that's what we often do, but sometimes you have harder days than others and you don't find that hope. So I think for him, you talk about the compounding, and I think over the years, there was just a reality to it, which is, this isn't really getting better. These emergencies are always going to happen. The threats against my, you know, livelihood are always going to happen. He gave this, he told us about this moment where he tried to save someone, was giving them CPR, and they said, if he dies, you die. And it just puts it in perspective. You take it so personally.
So what was the turning point to where he decided, or maybe didn't decide, maybe someone helped him decide, you know, it was time to get help?
A friend on the fire department went to him and asked him how he was doing. Simple question, how are you? And that's when he says he let it slip that he had his gun to his head three times. And this friend on the fire department said, all right, you're going to Maryland, which is a center that's offered to firefighters in Milwaukee as an inpatient treatment.
And it's funny because I was recently, I have a friend who is a former Milwaukee fire administrator, retired now. And we were just over the summer at a cabin up north, and we're visiting, and we're having coffee on the couch in the morning. He and his wife are sitting across from my wife and I. We talked to him about, boy, you must have seen a lot of things in your career. And his wife said, yeah, you know, I didn't realize all the things he'd seen until the other fire guys came up to the cabin, and they all started talking and reminiscing about some of those things. He'd kept them all inside. And I wonder about that with Brent here, with Lieutenant Jones. Is it's one thing to have experienced all of that and to have the trauma that's building up from all of that, but do firefighters talk about this stuff? Do they open up? Do they keep it all inside? And how much does that impact the need to go get help at a place like this place in Maryland?
When I started the story with talking with the chief of Milwaukee Fire, Aaron Lipsky, he said the biggest thing for us is peer-to-peer support. And you hear something like that, and I think, well, is that really a thing? You know, is peer-to-peer mm-hmm. support just saying, hey, how are you? He said, no, it's something we have in place. It's meant to open up the communication lines between our firefighters, because they go through what each other goes through every single day. They have to talk. So that's kind of the first tier of their support structure at MFD. But I do think in general, there's also a stigma surrounding asking for help and talking about it. And I think that was another thing that, you know, Brent Jones said, I had this image of perfection. You didn't talk about it. You were this, you know, this guy who, I was a former Marine. You know, I'm a Marine, I'm a firefighter. I have to uphold this image of the community. I wasn't going to talk about the moments of weakness.
Well, and he's the guy at the honor guard things where people are leaning on him for right. their support. Mm-hmm. He's got to be strong. Or at least in those moments. And I guess at times you go and I heard that say, it was very, he said it very softly. He talked about having his gun to his head three times. I mean, that's the moment. And the fact that he is still here to talk about it is remarkable, but he nearly wasn't. And I imagine he has a lot of compassion for others who might be in that very spot he once was.
Yeah. And he, Sarah, when we were putting this together, we're talking about how do we talk about the resources that are available to firefighters? And he said, you know, people always say they're there for you. We're here for you in those worst moments. We're here for you. Mm-hmm. But he said, when I was there with my gun to my head, no one was there for me. Mm-hmm. No one was sitting in that room with me. That was just me. And those are things that, that was something he had said when he was testifying later on after he was recovered and things like that. Those are things he didn't share with me in the interview, but it's clear that over the years he's been more candid about what he's experienced. It's kind of been a process for him, I would imagine.
Well, and we also mentioned 988 as well, which is a you know, it's been a year now, but it's still relatively new. And that's also another thing where, you know, I think part of it too was talking about how firefighters and first responders and police are all kind of in that whole, you know, sometimes they're working doubles or, you know, back to back kind of shifts. And so there's certain things that maybe their profession is exposed to or does that maybe, I'll say like a 9-to-5 Monday through Friday isn't. Obviously, the scenarios are different as well. But I do think that 988 is also another resource in addition to the peer-to-peer stuff.
Yeah. And the response time for a 988 is obviously paramount for someone like a right. paramedic or firefighter who, hey, I just have a couple of minutes. I just got to talk to someone. Mm-hmm. So that's huge.
And you talked about the testifying too. Can you talk a little bit more about that? He went to Madison.
Yeah. So, for him, when he went to inpatient treatment, Milwaukee Fire offered that as an option. Kind of the most serious option is inpatient treatment for mental health related issues, PTSD, things like that. And so he spent 44 days in an inpatient treatment center. He had to use sick time that he had accrued to go. So he wasn't covered under like a short-term disability or something like that. So that's where he felt really passionately like, this is not right. This should be covered in the same way. If you break your foot on the job, that's covered. So why is this injury that I've gotten from the job not covered? So Act 29 was, he testified in favor of this, which basically said any mental related injury like PTSD from the job is covered under workers' compensation. And he gave incredible testimony about why he thought that that should be applicable for police and fire. And that later went on to pass in 2021.
Yeah, I did what I tend to do as an investigative reporter after I watch your story. I want to go back and read about Act 29.
Fascinating.
It really is fascinating. What I thought was very interesting is it specifically points out that the sort of legal distinction here, the importance of this is it's stress that's suffered on the job that is not over and above the stress that anybody else on the job is experiencing. And that was critical because you think about the fire service. Well, everybody on the fire department is dealing with this death and misery. Mm-hmm. So for you to go, if the threshold is I'm only going to be covered if I've experienced something extraordinary beyond the norm. Mm-hmm. Well, in a profession like that, the norm is the norm? Pretty
yeah.
awful.
Yeah, right. I think they called it an unusual amount of stress.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, how is that not?
Right, right.
Yeah.
What would be an unusual amount of stress in the fire service when you are responding to fatal fires and mm-hmm. car crashes and things? And for someone who's been through all of that, and I think that's one of the challenges. I do wonder if that's not one of the challenges is when you look around and you go, well, all these other firefighters, my colleagues, my brother, and the people who came before me, he's from a family with first responder service. You go, well, they all dealt with it, so I'm just supposed to deal with it. But this is a case where mental health is very individual.
Yeah.
But the stresses may be common to the job. And this is saying, even if they're the common stresses to this kind of job, you're going to get that help. You're going to get that coverage.
And the text says something like you can only experience up to 32 weeks of it three times in a lifetime. So it's not forever. I mean, certainly.
This is a lifetime disability or something.
Right, exactly. Yeah. But you have to think there is a degree of lifetime disability to it. And mm-hmm. and he said, I have changed. It doesn't mean for the worse, but I have changed. This has changed me. And I think that's a reality of any time you're experiencing what we've called secondary trauma in this piece. But mm-hmm. to a degree, I mean, it becomes your own trauma, which right. is less secondary and more first.
Primary. Yeah, trauma. Right, sure. right. Now, okay, so, you know, he's obviously using his voice to, you know, speak out in support of these, you know, this Act 21, and or 20, sorry, 29. But he's also has some more concerns about recruitment, retention. You know, what is his concern about, you know, this next group of firefighters?
His main concern is their age, how young they are and how much time they have to put in until they can retire. So he thinks, you know, at the 20 plus years that he put in, if they're doing the same in the world that we live in, which he says, you know, is violent, that you're dealing with violence every day, how are they going to survive it? Whether that's on the street, not getting shot, or by taking your own life. So I think those are two realities he feels passionately about, is we really need these young firefighters to talk about it more, the peer-to-peer support. There's also that like next level, which is clinician, talking to a clinician, and then it would be inpatient. So there are definitely, there's more of a structure in place now with Milwaukee Fire, from my understanding and talking with officials about this, that compared to even 10, 15 years ago.
I want to step back for a minute because I kind of steered the conversation and I didn't complete a thought earlier, which was you're talking about this center in Maryland where Lieutenant Jones went to get this treatment. And when I was bringing up my friend up north who was talking about this, he mentioned something about his wife saying, yeah, maybe you should have gone on to that place out east. And I was curious at the time. I wonder what that place is. It sounds special. Is this something that is specific to the fire service? Is it first responders? And is this a center that serves firefighters all around the country?
That's a good question. I would imagine probably most who have access, I'm not sure if it's across the whole country, but
Milwaukee firefighters
have that option. And I think the big thing that's changed now is before, obviously, you had to accrue time to go versus now it could be covered. If you have a diagnosed condition like PTSD, workers' comp would pay for you to go for up to 32 weeks at a time versus before with Brent Jones. Was he there for 44 days because he wanted to be, or was that just how much time he had? Mm-hmm. So that's, I think, a big shift.
So had he needed more time, it's a matter of, can I afford this? Because that's obviously, it's already hard enough to get people to get that help. He said it was a friend who said, you need to go.
Yeah.
But if you go, well, it's going to cost me, I just can't afford to do this.
Yeah.
I guess it sounds like he's saying some of these young firefighters can't afford not to.
I would agree. Do you have a thought on that?
No.
Oh.
But it's true. Yeah. I mean, and that's kind of how your story that we'll see tonight kind of wraps up, where he's like, these young firefighters have to continue the conversation or even just jumpstart the conversation and do it. Otherwise, he's concerned that the suicide rate among firefighters and first responders is going to skyrocket, double, triple even.
And his story is so unique because not only did he get the help he needed through this IAFF Center of Excellence, which I think, you know, really helped save his life, but he also had this role on Honor Guard, which seeing first responders who died by suicide, he knew what that would be like for another person to cover his funeral. And that was something that he said, that knowing that I would put someone else through that made me want to not do it. And so I think part of it was his role in Honor Guard that saved his life. Part of it was also the actual support that he received from the fire department, the people there, and the center out in Maryland.
You said one thing that I was thinking about, and that is he talked about the young firefighters and the number of years they'll have to go through all of this. When I first heard that he served 23 years and he retired, it's easy to go 23 years and retired. I wish I could do that. But then you think that's 23 years of day to day trauma and that's why it's sometimes hard to recruit people to police and fire jobs because sure, the retirement looks nice at the end, but the road there can be a really debilitating one.
And 1 year matters. You think if you do one more year, generally speaking, your pension gets a little bit bigger, right? The salary that you're pulling gets a little bit bigger. But for him, he said, this is enough. I've had enough.
I think that's a good time for us to go off the record. This is the part of the podcast where we get a little more casual and have a little fun by answering a question for which we have not prepared. And as usual, Sarah has that question for us this week. What do you have, Sarah?
I do. Okay, so this one might require a little bit of thought, but it made me laugh when I saw it. What is something that isn't a sport but feels like a sport?
Laundry.
Is it the carrying of the baskets, or what part of it?
All
is
of it
the longevity, the marathon of it?
No,
where it doesn't end.
No, I think it is the physicality of laundry that I don't think I realized when I was younger, but now that I'm 50 years old, I feel it because we have a 2-story house, so our laundry room is in the basement. Ooh. So every time I do a load, it's two stories down, mm-hmm. 2 stories back up, and then it's the actual. What I didn't realize is, and again, maybe this is just my own personal fitness level right now, but it's when you're I'm folding towels, I like to watch TV.
Yeah,
and I
while you're doing the laundry.
I'm folding towels, okay. I watch TV. I'll watch, you know, put on a Netflix show.
I'll watch Off the Record.
How much laundry do you have?
I wait. And then I have 6 baskets of laundry because I have, you know, the kids. And
there's a lot
and
of
towels,
humans in your house. Okay.
People, yeah. six people in the house. So my wife and I will do a let's throw a show on and try to make this, you know, not so miserable.
Fun.
And the thing is, then I'm watching the show and I'm folding towels. And at the end, I'm either out of breath or just slightly sweaty. And I go, what?
Yeah.
I was folding laundry. Yeah, if you have to shower and create more laundry because you were folding laundry.
But there's that brief 32 seconds where every piece of laundry in the house is clean and folded and put away. And then someone will inevitably throw something in.
That's
over.
Yeah. Do you have an answer?
I do.
Okay.
Gardening.
Oh, yes.
So it requires such an art practice. You have to be good about it every day. That's why I don't do it.
Yeah.
My mother-in-law babysits our daughter, Jane, and she said, oh, some beautiful flower hanging baskets. I was like, look, I've tried. If you buy them, I so appreciate it, but I will not be able to take care of them.
Yeah.
So if you buy them, you have to take care of them. So even on the weekend, she'll take them home.
Oh, that's so nice. She takes
custody of the flower baskets.
Honestly, last weekend, I remembered to water them. That was the first time I have in 2 months. So.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. But I bet they look great.
Yeah. Okay. I'll send you a picture tomorrow.
Did you have something in mind on this?
I don't know. I was trying to think of I will joke that here at Fox 6, it's two floors, well, a basement as well, but people will come up the staircase and they'll come in my office because it's kind of right off the staircase and they start talking and then they're like,
stair climbing?
It's with the staircase. Oh. And I always make the joke that I'm like, it's okay. I think there's less air in that staircase. There's not the air
right,
flow.
But
I
right,
swear everyone that comes up the stairs. So that makes me laugh. But I will say sometimes trying to organize a time to get together with friends or other couples or whatever for dinner or an event is like a sport because you're like, okay, here are the dates that work for me. And then someone inevitably replies and goes, neither of those work, but this other one works. And then, you know, Johnny replies and he can't do any of them, but he can do September.
Yeah. So we're in the phase where nap time rules all. So I'm like, you can't do from 1 to 1?
No.
5?
Yeah. Yeah.
Have you ever, when you're trying to get a group together and then you put a little poll out, like would this weekend or this weekend work best? And then you come back and they're split 33%.
Ooh.
And you're like, come on.
And then you're like, okay, who is not going to be able to come because
ones?
We're,
exactly.
Who do we like the most? Yeah.
Who's Kale. Making, so first right,
so
stream,
I got
second
this.
Stream, right?
Yeah. Okay.
It's Costco shopping on a Saturday.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
So you need to limber up. You got to have the agility because you're going through with your big cart and then you got to have the stamina because you're there for a while.
You're right.
And then you have to have the strength because you got to lift the boxes of huge stuff that you just
Do you want a box? And I'm like, yes.
Yeah.
What am I going to do? Carry
45 pounds
item
of ranch dressing.
Yeah.
Then what?
I hate having the boxes to break down at home. So I end up taking all the individual things. But then when I get home, I'm like, why did I do
that?
I'm an
idiot.
Yeah. I have actually, I'm not ashamed to admit this. I've gone into the house and gotten garbage bags, brought them back out and loaded them up with stuff.
What about like the
carrying them in
breath.
Like Santa Claus.
The chicken breasts don't leak stuff. You know,
well, I mean, I guess if you're forgetting, those big, because Costco's giant things.
That,
No, that's a good point. I probably get a box sometimes, but I hate getting them because then I've got to break them down. And I am the box breaker downer in the house. And my
official
wife
title.
So I will tell you the other sport is that's it.
Yeah,
it's my Amazon box breaking down.
Wait,
is a sport that I am a professional. I'm an all-star.
Do you throw it
I'm an MVP.
Door?
Yeah.
And you have to break them all down.
Do you wait and do a bunch? Because that drives me bonkers.
So
I break them down as I get them.
They come in so fast and furious sometimes that I, and my stepson has started ordering more things too. He's 20 years old, but he's still living at home and he's ordering things. His mom is ordering things. I occasionally do. And those boxes do sometimes stack up. And when they do, I throw them down the stairs. and they sit at the bottom of the stairs until people get tired of walking around them, and I'm hoping they'll break them down. No, they don't.
No, they don't.
I'll just find them on the garbage can or on the recycle bin stacked up in boxes.
Just ready for you.
So then I know it's time.
Yeah, step one.
I've got a box cutter and I've got a whole, like 100 pack of blades because I don't like dull blades.
You're not messing around.
When I'm cutting boxes, I want sharp blades and
be careful with those little fingers.
You never do the punch? You just punch through the box, so then you have to.
I've tried the punch, and sometimes it's just not.
I cut them up real nicely in little squares, and then I put them all. They fit in the recycle bin real nice, and that's my sport. Like I said, I am the most valuable player in box cutting.
What about one more? What about when you leave a sporting event or a concert? Mm-hmm. That's like a sport, right? Like when you have to leave with all the traffic.
Oh, like trying to get
trying to get out.
Like leaving Foo Fighters this weekend at Hartley. Yeah.
Sometimes or, it's well, easy. That's, then that was you're a like, mess. Eh. Like if I leave too early, then it's like, oh, you probably should have stayed for one more song.
That's right. That's fair. Yeah.
I've always been a stay till the end of the game kind of person. My parents raised me. We go to the game. I grew up in St. Louis.
We
everyone
paid
knows.
Good money for these seats.
Yeah. Everyone knows, and many people around here are very last out. Hate me for this, but Cardinals fan growing up. But we went to Busch Stadium, and if the Cardinals were getting destroyed in a game, you stayed till the end. If they were winning, you stayed till the end. So whenever I am with someone who's like, eighth inning, let's try to do the L.A. beat the
absolutely
traffic kind of move.
Not.
No. Yeah. You stay until the end, and I think that's...
I definitely... leave early
for to a game together
for sports games, but for concerts I'm there till the last second.
Yeah,
and I'm like, they might come out
you just
third
never
time.
Know that's what I'm saying.
Yeah,
encore kind times two.
Old age, I'm leaving early.
We are all athletes from what I hear. I mean, yeah, Costco, I mean, there's games that we are
boxes,
athletes
there's, okay.
in our own way. Suzanne, thank you for being on Open Record. It's great having you back here. If you have an issue you would like us to discuss on Open Record or a topic you think we should investigate for Fox 6 News, send us an email to fox6investigators@fox.com. As always, thank you to the people who make this podcast possible, including our executive producer, Sarah Smith, our editor, Dave Machuda, and our chief photographer manning the video switcher, Kale Zimney. With that, I'm Brian Polson. We'll be back next week.